Hello and welcome to Quadriga, the international talk show coming to you from Berlin. I'm Brian Thomas. With the world seeing more and more extreme droughts, supercharged hurricanes, and catastrophic floods, millions around the world want to see action on coping with climate change. Among them, of course, the protesters have taken to the streets demanding governments and corporations do something to prevent the worst. The UN Climate Summit in the Polish city of Katowice is a step in that direction as it hammers out guidelines for implementing the Paris Climate Accord of 2015. But reaching consensus is growing more difficult as distrust in multilateralism and international bodies like the UN rises. Climate Summit, last chance for humanity. To discuss this question today, I'm joined by Petra Pinsler. She's working for Germany's leading weekly Die Zeit. She and her family tried out the climate-neutral lifestyle, and she wrote a book about her experience. She says, in spite of all the climate conferences, most people just don't realize how much their own personal lifestyles speed up climate change. Everybody can make a difference here and now. Grace Dobusch works for Handelsblatt Global, and she says, business can put the brakes on climate change, but first, it has to realize it's in the driver's seat. And Claudia Kempfert is head of the Energy, Transportation and Environment Department at the German Institute for Economic Research. She's a professor of energy economics and sustainability. She says effective measures for climate protection free up enormous economic potential for modernization, innovation, and technological progress. We need an intelligent framework, she says, to enhance these economic opportunities. Welcome to the show, everyone. Let's start out with the big question that's on our minds right now. What is our situation? When you listen to the conference in Katowice, it sounds like there's nothing we can do. If we could start with you, what do you think, Claudia?
We can do a lot, but I'm quite optimistic that in Poland they come together and work on concrete plans, although it's not fast enough. But there are a lot of countries that want to cooperate, and we needed this alliance of cooperation really to act. There are some countries who are out, but we have to move forward.
Grace, are you that optimistic?
We could do a lot of things. Governments could do, but they don't. And I would actually argue we personally can do a lot, but a lot of people don't. And it's not that difficult to do things. Just stop flying, for example. When you fly, compensate. Or think about the car you're driving. So little things you can change right away. The thing is that most people really don't know yet.
Okay, now Petra, you did this climate-neutral lifestyle. We'll talk about that later, but was it helpful? Do you think it makes a difference?
It was fun, yeah. And it makes a difference not just because we changed our lifestyle and had the feeling afterwards we live better than before, but a lot of our friends also got some ideas and things to talk about. So it was fun and it was good.
Okay, Grace. I called Petra Grace accidentally. Grace, what do you think? Where are we right now?
The situation looks dire right now. Some numbers just came out this week from the conference showing that carbon emissions are up this year from last year, which is terrible, of course. I think the question now is how to bring business and industry on board with making changes willingly, not waiting for agreements and not waiting for government restrictions to make changes.
Okay, well, is it too late to halt climate change and global warming? Some experts say that even if we did cut our carbon emissions radically over the next 1 to 2 decades, we would still fail to prevent the worst effects. This year will go down in history as the year the planet started paying us back. That's according to the head of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. So how bad was 2018? Let's take a look.
After an extended drought, California suffered the worst forest fires in its history, leaving nearly 90 people dead and hundreds missing. A devastating monsoon in India killed nearly 400 people in the state of Kerala. In Kenya, 2 years of drought have led to uncontrollable flooding that has left 250,000 people homeless. Hurricane Michael wreaked havoc on western Cuba before slamming into Florida. And Germany was taken aback by an unusually long, dry, hot summer. The effects of climate change are in plain sight everywhere you look. But we're still emitting carbon gases like there's no tomorrow. Experts warn that if we continue on like this, global temperatures could increase by 3 to 5 degrees by the end of the century. The result would be drastically elevated sea levels, torrential floods, extreme droughts, and millions of climate refugees.
For many people, regions, even countries, this is already a matter of life or death.
Will governments take action now?
Well, have global leaders failed to convince the public that something can be done to halt global warming? Petra, if I can ask you a question, why is there not more of a public pushback against the government's failure to create some kind of action that we could call meaningful at this point?
I actually have the feeling that the unease of people is growing. If you look at Germany, we had a huge demonstration against coal mines just recently, 50,000 people, which is not a billion or a million, but it's quite something, went on the streets and asked the government to stop firing coal. And if you look at the polls, 80% of the Germans are against using coal still for energy. So people, and especially young people, they start to feel it. Because it's not us, it's people now in their 20s who in 20 years will have to face the consequences.
Claudia, you're shaking your head. You're in agreement. Yeah. Is Germany an exception, though, that 80% that want to see this kind of action?
We see that also in other countries, that there is a strong commitment and also young people, a grassroots movement towards more action on climate protection. We see that actually also in the US, but in many countries as well. But the government has to react, and they have to make a framework that industries invest into renewable energy, electric mobility and all this. So we really need this push from the bottom that the governments are acting.
Okay, Grace, you've recently been in San Francisco. You know, we're talking about reaching some very ambitious goals to stop climate change. But if you look at California, for example, and it's not alone. Here in Europe, it's a similar situation with Portugal, with France, with Spain. The government regularly, local governments or state governments, fail to put in, for example, in forests, the kind of fire breaks that would at least stem the worst of forest fires. If we can't get that straight, how are we going to get the more ambitious goal straight?
That's the problem, right? I think a lot of times individuals are so focused on climate change as they see it in their local communities, when really these have to be global initiatives and governments as a whole have to be on board with making these changes. In Germany, of course, more than 80% of people believe that climate change is caused by humans. In the United States, a poll earlier this year found that 75% of Democrats believe that climate change is caused by humans, less than a third of Republicans, which account for about half of America, believe that climate change is caused by humans. There's just a problem of realizing this issue and taking it seriously.
But there are campaigns, and that's a problem, from those who want to protect the fossil capital, to protect the coal, protect oil, protect all this. And they are starting with campaigns, and this is why the people believe
that. Those campaigns have been going on for decades, absolutely.
And the science, as us, have to react and show what are the scientific facts. And they are clear that climate change is human-made and is real, and we have to react.
Okay, was it a failure then of scientists in France, for example, to effectively communicate their message when you look at the protests there that have forced President Emmanuel Macron to climb down, to back down on his environmental tax to promote green energy? What went wrong with convincing the people of France that this tax is something that they should pay?
Yeah, I think they are convinced, but it's the question how you do it, because the car tax and this diesel tax is problematic if only low-income persons have to pay it and don't get it back. So you need to have the tax income, which is paid back to the people. And this is also important, also for the German debate, that if we want to increase the tax for the environment, we have to give it back in another way and make also environmental mobility more attractive, like electric cars, like public transportation. And this is important, that the people get this back and not only have to pay it.
Petra, what do you think of it? When we look at tax policy to promote green energy, to get out of fossil fuels, what do we need to do to get that right so it's accepted by the population that's paying taxes?
I think the framing is very important. If right-wing and populist parties will be able to frame more environment protection as something that's bad for poor people, then the cause is lost. But it's possible to do it the other way around if you frame it as an issue which will help your children to survive, which actually will make your life easier and better, then we can win the cause. And if you look at the population in the cities, life can be better with less cars. Because the air is healthier, life can be better if people eat less meat, because everybody says it's healthier. So if you frame it as something that's good for you, for your family and for your life, and something that's organized in a way that's just, then I think it's going to be a good thing.
Grace,
what
do you think for the United States? Is it a matter of framing? If you got this message across to the public in the United States, would it work?
Well, I think one of the issues with framing the issue of climate change is that for so long it has been focused on doomsday scenarios, on trying to scare people into action, which hasn't worked. That message has been the main argument for decades. And I think what we need to do now is really focus on building a better future rather than how will we pay to clean up this mess. One interesting initiative that's being done in British Columbia and Canada is a recasting a carbon tax as a carbon dividend, where businesses are paying in for their carbon emissions. That money is then being funneled back to residents in the form of a check every quarter or year, where they're actually then seeing that money. That type of new thinking, I think, could be interesting for other industrialized countries to pursue.
That the transition will actually be profitable for me as an individual.
Always a good way to convince people with money.
That sounds like the easiest way to get that communicated and sold effectively, doesn't it? Well, the UN Climate Conference in the Polish city of Katowice has been working on an implementation plan to rein in some of the worst effects of climate change that you've seen here on the show. And it's had some star power on hand to drive home its message.
That I could be the Terminator in real life, to be able to travel back in time and to stop all fossil fuels when they were discovered.
Okay, so that might have helped some of the conservatives in America, right? Get on board. You like that, Grace. You're laughing. You like Arnold Schwarzenegger's point there, the Terminator for climate change.
Yeah, let's terminate climate change.
Okay. You know, when we look at the conference in Katowice, its goal is to implement the plans moving forward that a number of nations have agreed to. Petra, what are some of the implementation action that's going to come out of this conference? What do you see as some of the concrete steps coming out of Katowice?
I think very important is that the rich countries give money to the poor countries to fight climate change, because in a way we are much more guilty of climate change than poor countries, because we started industrialization earlier. We used much more coal than poor countries did. Their emissions are still much lower than ours. But still, if we want to fight climate change, every country has to do so. But the rich have to help the poor to do so. The second thing that's quite important is that people, that the countries and the governments come up with ambitious plans how they do it. Because it's not just okay and fine to promise something. You really have to fulfill the promises. And what we see up to now is that the plans that the governments are bringing to Katowice, they're just not enough. They're not ambitious enough.
And Claudia, is that the way you see it? Not enough ambition?
Well, there are some countries who are very ambitious, but they are not enough. But now I think in Katowice it's important that they combine their initiatives and go and move forward, because we have to convince countries like the U.S. To come back on board on this international treaty, although in the U.S. the emissions are not rising because they substitute coal with gas. And that's a way of how to do it. But we need more countries to act, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is right. We have to move away from fossil fuels and bring more renewables, channel the investments to the new markets. This brings jobs and improves the health and also improves the environment and the economy. And that's something where we can really all win.
What do you tell people in America who bought into the argument that when you get rid of fossil fuels as the industrial base, you're going to deindustrialize the nation? That's what Donald Trump has been saying, and he's gotten a lot of traction with that. What do you say to counter that to people in the U.S.?
Well, we have the same argument in Germany as well. And what we saw with the investment into renewables, that we do not have a deindustrialization, we have a reindustrialization. The industry in Germany is the most strongest on the world. And this is also because we have investments into renewables, into new markets. And those countries who do that are winning this race. Those countries, like the US and others, who stick to the past and think the fossil fuel is the answer of the future, they are wrong, and they will be proven that it will be wrong, and they are losing jobs, they are losing economic strength, and that's important.
Okay, now China's big the United States' big competitor right now, it was Russia politically, but China economically, is in the process of shifting itself to alternative energies. And at the same time, though, it's investing in foreign fuel projects in other areas in Asia and in Africa as well. What do we say to people who are very critical of China playing what they call a dual game in how they're approaching changing into a more environmentally friendly form of energy?
I kind of see the U.S. and China working in similar ways at the moment, in that we're both extremely reluctant to get off of fossil fuels. But the only way forward is really to invest in renewable energies and then also see the job benefits that are going to come from renewable energies. Some studies earlier this year showed that focusing on renewables, although it would lead to tens of millions of jobs being lost within the fossil fuel industry, would create even more in renewable energy. And so I don't think that there's a risk of deindustrialization. It's just a new world that we have to adapt to.
There's one more similarity between the US and the China that I found very interesting. They both try to compete Germany in the next generation of cars. Mm. China is investing very heavily into e-cars and parts of the US as well. And Germany is kind of lagging behind. Mm-hmm. So there, I think they're really leading the world into something better.
And that is an economic risk for Germany, because a lot of jobs are also to the car industry in Germany. And this is, if we do not invest into new technologies, into electric mobility, for example, we are losing these jobs.
And
this is an argument for deindustrialization.
It is one of the big challenges coming up. And we want to talk about that right now, because Germany has been, as you mentioned, at the forefront of the fight to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, the struggle is given a new urgency when German cities were threatened to ban diesel cars and trucks after courts found them not in compliance with clean air regulations. Now, this led to the diesel summit here in Germany to keep the traffic flowing and to clean up the air at the same time. Now, the diesel summit was considered long overdue in light of the criminal charges brought against German car makers for manipulating emission software.
Germany's car industry has long been synonymous with quality. But the reputations of flagship companies like Volkswagen became tarnished in the wake of the Dieselgate scandal. Wide-scale emissions cheating has contributed to high pollution levels in urban areas. German courts have started to impose bans on diesel cars in city centers. The transport sector accounts for some 20% of the country's carbon emissions, a figure that is still rising. As one of Germany's largest employers, the car industry has long enjoyed a great deal of leeway. Chancellor Angela Merkel has also been reluctant to acquiesce to EU-wide emissions targets and expensive retrofitting of manipulated vehicles. Domestic automakers have also dropped the ball on investment in green vehicles. Of a total of 46 million vehicles on Germany's roads, just 54,000 are electric. Often cited as the world's biggest polluter, China has overtaken the competition, thanks in part to hefty e-mobility subsidies. By 2025, electric vehicles are to make up at least a fifth of Chinese auto sales. E-car quotas and subsidies, is this the future of climate protection?
So, Petra, Die Zeit, what do you think? Are diesel cars and trucks headed to the dump heap of history within the next 1 to 2 decades?
I'm very sure about it. because we all know that the emissions are too high in Germany in the traffic sector due to fossil burning cars, not just the diesel. The diesel was longer regarded as being more climate friendly than other cars, which is not true any longer, because what they did is they built bigger and bigger cars. So when you look at the new cars in Germany, diesel are not more climate friendly than other cars. We have to switch to electric mobility. And even though Germany might be lagging behind, other countries will lead, because countries with less car industry, they put all kinds of limits into diesel being allowed, for example, to drive into Paris. I think in 2030, they will not be allowed any longer. Yeah. The other countries will go along. What we can see in Germany and what we can learn as a lesson is what happens when a company, not just a company, a whole sector becomes too powerful. Then it can actually frame change. And the car companies and the car industry has been far too powerful in Germany, unfortunately.
But if you look at the upstarts like Tesla in the United States, there's a lot of hope for the electric car industry in the West, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. And it's a big economic chance, because they invest into new markets and there's a huge competition. And the German car industry is very strong in Germany. There are almost 1 million jobs in the car sector in Germany. And we are losing those if we are not investing into the future. And they're very strong because they are also looking to the past and not investing into the future. And this is why it's so important to change.
We just saw top German CEOs meeting with the president in the White House, and Ford and VW are going to start a cooperation. Do you see some opportunity there? What do you think, Grace?
I think that any car company that isn't investing in electric research is completely fooling themselves about the future of mobility. I think we're also going to see a lot more in the way of shared mobility, not only ride-hailing services, but these types of autonomous vehicles being merged with public transportation. With the urbanization of cities around the world, it's going to just be more and more important to get cars off the streets and get people into shared or at least electric vehicles.
There's some economic advantages there, Claudia.
Yeah, a lot. And we have, at the first place, also to reduce the whole traffic, but also to optimize it. And the train traffic is as important as individual driving. And the economic opportunities are huge, not only because of electric driving and the digitalization you mentioned. This autonomous drives will bring the future. And I think there's a huge market ongoing, because you can couple it with renewable energy, decentralized electricity production, storage, which is needed also for the energy change. So there are huge markets, new technology, innovation, new jobs, and that's great.
The very interesting thing is that it's not just an economic thing, it's also a question of well-being. There are a couple of interesting research, there's a couple of interesting research studies out there which actually say that people feel the less happy when they travel with their own car to their job. So they feel that this time is wasted. Imagine you don't have to travel and drive your car any longer, but you could just sit somewhere and read your newspaper, because it's not just electrified, but it's also driving autonomously. So it can make life better to have less traffic.
Okay, and it is a personal choice, and that's what we want to talk about now. Not driving a car at all is one way people can reduce their carbon footprint. Climate researchers here in Berlin tracked a family of five as they adjusted their lives to be as climate neutral as possible. Here's what that family discovered as they worked on doing that.
Karin Beese, her husband Henry, and their children Hanna, Mira, and Nika. The whole family is part of an experiment to drastically reduce their carbon footprint. They travel almost everywhere by bike, and they shop for groceries at a local market. Most of their produce is from Germany, but this pepper is from Spain.
We don't eat meat, and we eat more vegetables in autumn and winter. A pepper from Spain isn't ideal, but it's better than putting salami on a pizza.
They know that just 1 kilogram of beef costs about 12 kilograms of CO2. Each week, they tally their carbon expenses for food, electricity, transportation, and other daily necessities. How does it all affect their yearly balance?
25.18 tons as a family. That's 5 tons per person.
Not bad. If they continue living like this, they'll go beyond the 40% goal and reduce their footprint by 56%. But can everyone lead such a climate-neutral life?
Our last question today, how realistic is it to expect people to live a carbon-neutral life?
It might be realistic if the alternatives are attractive. It's not eating meat, but instead eating vegetables is healthy, it makes fun, and also flying with climate-neutral fuels is important also to neutralize your emissions, and then it has to make fun, but it can be.
Petra.
Just tell people to Google their global footprint, their CO2 footprint, look at the results, and then make them think about their children. That will change their life.
Okay, so you can Google your carbon footprint. Grace, what do you think?
I think, honestly, we need to get industry and energy producers on board with this. Whether I take a bus to work or drive a car makes such a small difference as compared to how energy producers are burning coal using solar. I think the important thing is to end subsidies for fossil fuels, which account to trillions of dollars a year, to make it expensive for these people to be burning fossil fuels.
Okay, so part of the personal lifestyle would be taking a political position and getting some action there. Okay, I'd like to thank all my guests for being with me today here on Quad Riga, and I'd like to thank you as well. I'm Brian Thomas. Don't forget, we'll be back next week. Goodbye. Until then.